listening to Pythagoras' Trousers.
Hello and welcome to this month's Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North. But most of this episode will actually come courtesy of Dr. Ian Harrison, a cosmologist based here in Cardiff. Ian reported from the National Astronomy Meeting, which we held in Cardiff back in July, and spoke to a number of people. You can hear a couple of interviews we conducted on the previous episode of Pythagorean Astronomy. But coming up, we have a bit of a deep dive into machine learning and what we mean by modelling in astrophysics. But first, Ian spoke to Dr. Susanna Azzoni about the cosmic microwave background and what we're learning from observations of the afterglow of the Big Bang, including the polarisation of the light and how that helps us separate the background light from all the light from pretty much everything else in the universe in the foreground. I think it's best if I hand over to Ian and Susanna, who will take it from here with the first of Ian's three interviews.
I'm here at the National Astronomy Meeting in Cardiff, and I'm here with Susanna Azzoni, Dr. Susanna Azzoni, of the University of Oxford, who is here. And I saw your talk in one of the sessions yesterday, and you spoke about the cosmic microwave background, which I think our listeners know is the oldest light from the universe from just after the Big Bang. And in your talk, you spoke about the information we can get from the polarization in the cosmic microwave background. I didn't know if you can start off just by giving us a quick description of what the polarization of the cosmic microwave background tells us about what the early universe looked like.
Right, yes. So in principle, as you say, when we're looking at the CMB, we're essentially looking at this furthest away picture of the universe. And this is just, in practice, electromagnetic radiation, so we can describe it with just temperature and polarization. And by looking at the temperature, we can look at the kind of density fluctuation that were at the very beginning of the universe and understand how this gave rise to the kind of structure that we see today at larger scales and smaller scales as well. So like galaxies, stars, and so on. Then by looking at the polarization, we can gather information about what happened even further away from this very first picture of the universe that we have out there. And in particular, there is this theory that is the theory of inflation, which tells us that at the very beginning of the universe, we have quantum fluctuations at very small scales that get accelerated and blown up by this accelerated expansion of the universe. And what that means is that this gave rise then to the kind of density fluctuations, but also the so-called primordial gravitational waves, which then give rise to the polarization of the CMB light that we observe.
So you say there's the gravitational waves, and of course there's been some news recently about people detecting one type of gravitational wave emission by looking at pulsars and monitoring those. And by looking at the polarization of the CMB, you can also detect these gravitational waves. But those gravitational waves are ones that were laid down in the very early universe by this period of inflation. What does the polarization tell us about the gravitational waves, and what do the gravitational waves tell us then about inflation?
Right, so by looking at this polarization in the CMB, we have traces of this so-called primordial gravitational waves, which are expected with this theory of inflation that just tells us that the quantum fluctuations then get blown up to macroscopic scales. So by looking at this polarization, we are actually looking at two components of it. One is the so-called electric component, so the E modes and B modes, which is the kind of magnetic component of it. And one of the things we are particularly interested in to study the very early universe is this B modes, because the amplitude of these fluctuations that are related to the primordial gravitational waves tells us what the energy scale of inflation at the beginning was. And so we're trying to constrain what the amplitude of this primordial gravitational wave was. And so then trying to prove whether this theory of inflation is accurate or not to describe the beginning of the universe.
Yeah. Cool. And then those energy scales, they're really high, right? They're much higher than the energy scales that we can get to with kind of particle colliders and things.
Yeah, exactly.
So then I guess the different types of, I don't know if you can say, know anything about different types of particle physics, I guess. Is it different types of particle physics that you can tell the difference between?
Well, you can probe different kinds of theories for the beginning. And as you say, it's really nice the fact that we can probe energies that we cannot probe any other way with cosmology and with this kind of cosmology especially.
Which is super cool. So yeah, we're really interested in these kind of particle physics, but you're also speaking about some of the other things that kind of also are in our microwave telescopes when we point them at the sky looking for these cosmic microwave background polarization. So yeah, you mentioned a few of the different types of microwave emission. So I don't know if you can describe which ones there are and which ones were the most problematic for us when we're trying to do this cool early universe particle physics.
Right, yes. So in practice, when we're looking at the CMB, this is just the furthest point away from us, as I was saying before. And what that means is that there is a lot of stuff in between when we observe. And the main thing that gets in the way of our observation of this very faint signal is the so-called foregrounds. And the main foregrounds that we have there are the ones coming from our galaxies. So it's just the signal coming from our galaxy in there that emits at the same frequencies of the CMB and emits everywhere in the sky. So it dominates the signal that we're looking at. And in particular, two of these components that are the strongest one that overcome the signal that we're looking at are the so-called synchrotron, which comes from the acceleration of cosmic ray electrons in the galactic magnetic field, and dust, which is the thermal emission from interstellar dust grains. And these just cover everywhere our signal in the sky. And so it makes it really, really difficult for us to find the CMB B-mode. And the lucky thing is that these signals are very different at different frequencies. And so we can use the fact that they are very different at different frequencies to observe at these different frequencies and then have a good characterization and understanding of this foreground emission and so what our galaxy looks like, and we can take it away from our full observation. In practice, however, these signals are very are not precisely what we expect them to be, and they can vary a lot across the sky. So we need this, you know, complex pipelines to take them into account.
And this is the new thing that you've been researching, right? Is how to take account in that variation across the sky.
Right, exactly. And especially with the forthcoming experiments, which are much more sensitive, then we are even more sensitive to every kind of variation that we get in there and in our galactic signal. And so we need to have these very precise methods to take them into account, like the ones that I mentioned there, which take into account the spatial variation of the signal and then allows us to recover the actual CMB signal that we're looking at.
Nice. Yeah. So so I know you mentioned a few of the experiments you're working on. So you work on, is it right, the Simons Observatory,
right,
which is one which has some UK involvement, and then Lightbird as well.
Right.
So I don't know if you can tell us a bit more about how it is working in those collaborations and the different positives and negatives that the different telescopes have as well for these kind of things.
Right. So I really like working in collaboration in the sense that you get to meet very different people working on very different things, going from the theory and pure theory of the physics that we want to get to, and people that do purely instrumentation, so they have very different day-to-day problems to deal with. And it's nice to see that we all have a common goal, though, and so we all work towards the same scientific goal. It's tricky sometimes to actually coordinate everything, I would say, and get to the very details of these massive instruments that need to get to these extreme sensitivities that we've never seen before. So yeah, I guess these are the kind of ups and downs.
Nice. Yeah, I know. So working across these different time zones is sometimes very difficult, right? With Lightbird being in Japan and things like that. And yeah, it's good. So I think that was a really nice little insight into this new work that you've been doing with these CMB foregrounds. And thank you very much, and good luck for the future.
Thanks.
I'm here at the National Astronomy Meeting again, and I'm with Dr. Niall Jeffrey from University College London. And I was very interested in his talk at the National Astronomy Meeting, which I saw yesterday. And in your talk, you referred to the classic saying that all models are wrong, but some of them are useful. And I was wondering if you could say a bit more about how you think that concept interacts with astrophysics and with cosmology. How do we decide what is a useful model in astrophysics?
Yes. So maybe it's useful to start off saying what's a model. Yeah. And so a model could be something like the model that describes the whole universe, something like, is there dark energy or not? Is there a cosmological constant? But a model could also be, what's the way that galaxies form? How do they do galaxies with spirals are more blue, or do they have certain properties? Okay, so, and it's usually in science a process of building up these models, right? So yep. We learn something about a given system, like a galaxy, you know your model is wrong, and you might have multiple models, and then there's a process of building up a better model based on your data, but also based on thinking, right? Mm-hmm. Coming up with physics that you know based on things that happen on Earth, and how that could apply in an astrophysical context as well.
That's nice. So you spoke a bit about, you know, kind of quantitative ways to compare models, like you say, if you have different propositions for how a model for a galaxy, how it might have formed. So when do you know if your model is good enough? So if you're deciding between these different models, how much do you care about the reality and how well you are matching the reality, and how do you decide those things between the different models once you have a best model?
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because you can look back historically, and things that now seem obvious to us, at some point there was some kind of discussion about, like, whether the Earth is at the center of the solar system or not the solar system, the universe, or whether the sun is at the center and so on. And now that seems obvious to us, but you can see the process by which people discuss that, and by kind of accepting that one thing is true, that the sun is in the center, it enables you kind of thinking space. Once you assume that, you can then go on and build the more complicated models of astrophysics and gravity that you then get as soon as you accept that the sun is in the middle. And you can kind of think of analogies with galaxy formation. So if we take some data and we use a method that we've developed, neural network methods called evidence networks, that give you the odds that different models are true. So I might have two models about how a galaxy is formed, and I take the data and it gives odds of 10,000 to 1. Well, probably you'll say, well, I'll probably go with this model for now. Let's assume that's true because the data is pushing us in that direction.
So just that's odds that one model is better than the other, not that the model is true, right? Just,
well, it's the same thing. It's the probability that the model is true given your data, or rather the fraction of those. So the probability that this model is true about galaxy formation is 5,000 times bigger, for example, than the probability the other model is true.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
And so at that point, you just say, well, let's assume that model is true. And then this is how science works. There's a feedback effect. So other people now run simulations assuming that model is true. And that there might be some freedom there, some extra astrophysics. And then we loop back and it comes back again. And then we look at more data. And I think historically, that's how astrophysics is worked, because we're not able to run experiments in that way. So you kind of have to look at the data, kind of make a best guess. If your guess is true, or assume your guess is true, then do some more kind of development of the actual astrophysics.
Yeah, that's nice. And you spoke in your talk again yesterday specifically about some of that work you've been doing with these different models of how galaxies form on relatively smaller scales in the universe compared to, you know, the universe as a whole, and how that impacts on what we know about things like dark matter and dark energy, which exist on larger scales in the universe. So I didn't know if you could describe,
what some of those models are and the differences between them and yeah. what you're going to be testing them with in the next few years and that kind of data?
Yeah, sure. So the problem we have in a big cosmology experiment like Euclid, which was yep. launched a few days ago, is that we use the effect of gravitational lensing to reconstruct where the invisible dark matter is. But the problem is that dark matter is not just living in its own world. The dark matter gets moved around by effects going on in galaxies, and in particular very highly energetic effects from active galactic nuclei and supernova in particular, kind of these explosions almost that give energy to the gas in the galaxy and which blows matter away from the galaxy.
And those are on very much smaller scales than this lensing is happening, right? Because supernovae are individual stars, right? And,
yeah.
And galactic nuclei are individual galaxies. So it's yeah. Interesting to see this marriage of this relatively small scale and large scale world.
Exactly. And this is where the trouble comes, because we don't know the theory of how supernova works. We can't simulate supernova. And so we think of supernova as big things because they're exploding stars. So it's the size of like the sun exploding and then it goes much bigger. But actually compared to the size of a galaxy, that's much smaller. And on a computer, you can't resolve, you don't have high enough resolution to see both of those things happening at once.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of have to guess the way the supernova is working and put that into your simulation of the galaxy by hand. So that's where all the astrophysical uncertainty is coming from, yeah. And so because of this effect on the dark matter distribution, it's really important that we know how this physics works. And so what we're doing at the moment is taking these methods from artificial intelligence, these evidence networks, and then taking data about galaxies from, for example, the Sloan Digital Sky Survey,
mm-hmm.
to actually take sets of different simulations that contain our different effectively guesses about how this mm-hmm. physics works in galaxies, and ask the question, which one of these is true? And so the result of that process will give odds, as I said before. So it will say 5,000-to-1 odds that this model is correct, and that model corresponds to a simulation with a certain kind of guess about how the supernova works. And then based on that, we run more simulations, we look at different data, we look at data from X-rays of clusters of galaxies, and it feeds back in, and then it gives more opportunity for theorists and simulators to run new simulations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really nice description, both of the kind of scientific method and how it applies here, and what we'll be doing with some of that new data for those models in the next few years. So, yeah, thank you very much. That was really good.
Okay, cheers. Thank you.
Hi, I'm here at NAM still, and I'm talking to Dr. Ashley Spindler, who is a lecturer in data science and astronomy at the University of Hertfordshire. Hello.
Hello. Hi.
So I was very interested to go to the session that you were part of, one of the panel members for, about machine learning in astrophysics a few days ago. And I thought that was very interesting. So seeing the kind of explosion of machine learning methods in astrophysics over the past, you know, 5-ish years and maybe a bit more has been very interesting from my perspective. So I don't know if you can kind of describe how you think machine learning has become useful in astronomy and astrophysics, where it's been most useful, and kind of things that you've used for in your work.
Yeah, sure. So the pathway of this really arcs over about 10 years, and it's this explosion of a particular area of machine learning, which we call deep learning. Deep learning refers to using a type of algorithm called a neural network, which to a first order approximation mimics learning in biological neurons. So it's trying to mimic the kinds of things that brains do in a really simplified way. And with deep learning and on the hardware side of things, development of high-speed GPUs, graphical processing units, has been the driving force behind the entire explosion of machine learning and AI technologies that we see throughout society now. In astronomy in particular, the initial interest of ML technologies is in a field called image recognition. So astronomy is a very visual field,
yeah.
And basically everything we do comes down to looking at images and trying to discern facts about the universe from those images. And image recognition technologies allow us to perform certain tasks automatically via a computer, much faster than human beings would be able to do so. So the example I often give is the Galaxy Zoo galaxy morphology project, where citizen scientists would label the shapes of galaxies. One of the recent projects for that, which was headed up by Dr. Mike Walmsley at previously at still at University of Manchester.
I think previously at Oxford, now at Manchester.
Oxford,
I think he's still
now
at Manchester.
Yeah. I think he's moving to Toronto.
Yeah, people move. It's one of the good and bad things about.
Mike has been doing a lot of the recent work with Galaxy Zoo and integrating machine learning into that. And in order to manually classify the shapes of all of the galaxies in one of the recent data sets, which comes from a survey called Deckles, would have taken, I think the number is 50 years in order to, for citizen scientists at the current rate at which they engage with this website to classify all of these images. And that's not even in the realm of what was called, when I started my PhD, next generation astronomy. It's now kind of this generation of astronomy. When the Euclid Space Telescope, which just recently launched, starts sending back data, when the Vera Rubin Observatory starts collecting data for the Legacy Survey of Space and Time, LSST, we're going to have so many images, petabytes of images, which it's simply not possible for human beings to study all that data. And so machine learning algorithms, and in particular image recognition algorithms, allow us to tackle this mountain of data and continue doing the science that we want to do, continue learning about the properties of the universe through dark matter and dark energy, through to galaxy evolution and the life cycle of stars and transient events, supernovas, all of these things. More recently, there's been a lot of focus on anomaly detection, and this is a field of machine learning algorithms that are devoted to finding the weird, finding the stuff that doesn't fit with the rest of the data. And what you'll see if you look back over the last sort of 100 years of astronomical discoveries is they are so often driven by serendipity. Jocelyn Bell Burnell discovering pulsars, the discovery of the cosmic microwave background, even Hubble discovering the expansion of the universe, I should say, using data collected by Vesto Slipher. Not a lot of people know that.
Yep.
These were serendipitous discoveries. They were things that we weren't looking for when we found them. And serendipity is very difficult to achieve when you have too much data to look at. So anomaly detection is sort of a way to try and patch that gap and find the weird things that don't fit with our models. And it's going to be especially important with LSST and the SKA, when that finally comes online, there is going to be too much data for us to possibly search it all.
It's really interesting to be seeing these kind of things coming on now and getting us ready for this kind of next generation of telescopes, which are going to be producing these massive orders of magnitude more data. Do you think, has there been anything in your own science so far where you have kind of had a machine learning enabled result which has given you a scientific conclusion that you didn't have before as well? Or is that something which you think is safeguarding at the moment for the future experiments as well?
Yeah, so you know, a lot of the work that is being done in astronomy with machine learning is sort of in preparation for what's coming next. And this is something I mentioned in the panel we had the other day, that a lot of us that are doing this research are playing as computer scientists, mm-hmm. and we're doing this machine learning research and not always engaging with the science results that we could maybe be pulling out of the data that we're looking at. In my own work, I'm mostly interested in galaxy evolution and the evolution of galaxy structure. So the things I'm looking at is trying to trace back the evolution of galactic bars. And we're hoping that we can use some sort of cutting edge machine learning technology to search through these big data sets that are coming to find some of the earliest examples of barred galaxies around a time that has been called by other people the epoch of bar formation, which is, you know, a specific point in time when bars become stable structures.
Yes, really nice to connect it with that, because, you know, bars are also one of those morphology structures which are in the original kind of Hubble tuning fork diagram,
exactly.
Right, where you have
yeah.
very few objects and you
yes.
classify them according to whether they have this particular
yeah.
feature, this bar shape going through the middle of them. So
exactly.
looking for these in this next generation stuff with machine learning is
mm-hmm.
it's really cool. So what does the presence of a bar or not in a galaxy, how does that what does that tell you about its formation history and the physics
well,
of those kind
so
of things?
Bars are really interesting structures, and what's interesting about sort of the evolution of them is in the first sort of 5 billion years or so of the universe, bars could not form as stable structures. The universe was too dynamic, it was too hot. If a bar formed, it would maybe last a few 100 million years at most. And then we get a point when the universe is spread out enough that galaxies aren't sort of jostling each other with their gravity all of the time, that these bars start to form. And they form because of the orbits of the stars. They enter a resonance, which means they sort of stick in the same region of a galaxy, much like a spiral arm. And bars do a really interesting thing, is they channel all of the gas in the galaxy from the disk region, from the outer regions, into the central bulge. And so they sort of starve a region around the center of the galaxy, which we sometimes call a star formation desert, because
right.
All the gas gets drawn out and then it gets channeled into the bulge. And that leads to two things. It leads to a starburst, so you get lots and lots of stars forming in the center of the galaxy, and it also feeds supermassive black holes. So it can turn on these supermassive black holes, we call it active galactic nuclei,
yep. Yep.
Which then start churning out loads of radiation. And through those processes, bars fundamentally change the structure of the galaxy. They change the shape of the bulge, they make it sort of more of a boxy peanut shape instead of being a spherical object, and they can starve the spiral arms of the gas that they need to keep forming new stars.
Cool.
They're very interesting structures. We see in a lot of the differences of colours.
Mm-hmm.
So a barred spiral galaxy is generally redder
yep.
than an unbarred spiral galaxy, and that's due to this running out of gas.
Okay.
So the younger blue stars sort of die off and then leave these passive spirals behind.
Cool. Yeah, that's very cool, and yeah, it would be great to continue having that understanding of galaxy formation as we probe it further, I guess, into the past with these new surveys as well
mm-hmm.
and the machine learning method as well. So yeah, thank you very much.
No problem.
That's good.
That's it for the interviews from the National Astronomy Meeting. My thanks to Ian Harrison and, of course, his guests, Susanna Azzoni, Niall Jeffrey and Ashley Spindler. Don't forget you can subscribe to the podcast and find past episodes at pythagastro.uk or by searching for Pythagorean Astronomy on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Until next month, goodbye.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy, an extended version of this month's Astronomy Roundup from Pythagoras' Trousers, a weekly science and technology radio show presented by me, Rhys Phillips. You can catch up on full episodes of Pythagoras' Trousers, subscribe to our podcast, and get in touch by going to www.pythagoras-trousers.radio.fm.